Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID the Future, we hear the first of three parts of a conversation between two top thinkers on the question of the origin of life. James M. Tour is a world-renowned chemist, recipient of too many multiple prestigious awards, even to begin listing them here, named in 2014 as one of the 50 most influential scientists in the world. He's in conversation here with philosopher of science Stephen C. Meyer, director of the Center for Science and Culture, on questions regarding naturalistic research into the first life, including something as basic as knowing what life is. Without that, do researchers even know what they're looking for? Dr. Tour speaks first here.
You just took this in a direction that I was hoping it was going to go. You talked a little bit about the fine tuning of the universe. Now I want you to narrow that down and talk about the fine tuning that it would take to have life, or that it takes to have life. Talk about constants that you might know of, or the fine tuning around life itself.
I've got a new book coming out, as you know, about extending the argument for intelligent design in an overtly theistic direction. I think I've written, as if you, on the origin of life problem, and there's such exquisite evidence of design in the inner workings of the cell. But if you, at least theoretically, some have proposed, even Francis Crick proposed, that the cell was designed and transported here to Earth. He was so taken with the severity of the origin of life problem, he suggested that maybe life had been had arisen someplace else in the cosmos and then it had been seeded here. It was a theory called directed panspermia. But that's a strange theory. It doesn't really answer the ultimate question of the origin of biological information, for one, because to get life, you have to have that code that makes all forms of life possible. And so, in a sense, Crick and others who proposed this kind of kicked the problem out into deep space without answering the ultimate problem, which is where do you get the information, the code that makes life possible? But in addition to that, there's an even more fundamental level of design in the very fabric of the universe, the laws and the constants of physics, the initial conditions of the universe, and some of the contingent features of the universe, like the speed of light or the expansion rate of the universe or the cosmological constant. So I've been writing about these because this is a kind of design that can't possibly be explained by any being within the cosmos, because it's built into the very fabric of the universe from the very beginning. From the Big Bang forward, we've had this exquisite fine-tuning. So one of the first discoveries of this fine-tuning was made by Fred Hoyle, who was, at that point in his career, a very aggressive, or let's say overt, atheist. He had proposed the steady-state theory of the origin of the universe as an alternative to the Big Bang, because he saw that the Big Bang had obvious theistic implications. If the universe has a beginning, if the material and physical universe has a beginning, then you can't posit some material cause beyond the universe to bring it into existence, because matter and energy are what are coming into existence. And so Hoyle was troubled by that and came up with this steady state idea. It ultimately didn't pass the test of experience. Many observations were made that refuted it. But in the 50s, he had an abrupt change of metaphysical position, of worldview, when he discovered the fine-tuning that was necessary, the multiple fine-tuning parameters that were necessary to make carbon possible and oxygen possible. And he was a stellar astrophysicist and realized that to get it was called the resonance levels of carbon, the precise energy levels at which carbon would form from lighter elements, that a whole host of other fine-tuning parameters had to be just right. In particular, the heat inside stars during fusion, and that required very finely tuned amount of gravitation, a little too much one way, a little too little the other, and carbon would not be possible. Without carbon, you couldn't get complex chemistry. Without complex chemistry, you couldn't get life. And so there's been, I think, there's about three dozen of these fundamental fine-tuning parameters that have to be exactly right and within very narrow tolerances. So the physicists now sometimes talk about us living in a kind of Goldilocks universe where gravitational force constant is not too strong, not too weak. The electromagnetic force constant, not too strong, not too weak. The ratio between the two constants, very precise to make complex chemistry possible. And on it goes. And then the other form of fine-tuning is the fine-tuning that's required at the very beginning of the universe in the configuration of mass energy. We live in a universe now where you look out in the night sky, you have the right kind of telescope, you can see these beautifully ordered galaxies. But for there to be the amount of order we have in the universe now, there had to be an even greater amount of order, of low entropy at the very beginning of the universe. And the physicist Roger Penrose has calculated that degree of entropy fine-tuning, of initial entropy fine-tuning, and he's come up with an incredibly tiny exponential ratio, 1 in 10, a hyper-exponential, 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 123. You can't even get your mind around a number like that. So it at every level, the universe, in the setup job at the beginning, in the fine-tuning of the constants, the strength of the fundamental forces, and then finally in the structure of our solar system as well. As I mentioned, we're just the right distance from just the right kind of sun, with just the right axial tilt, with a Jupiter, big gas giant, sweeping the outer parts of the solar system, protecting us from asteroids. It's just exquisite, all the factors that are just right to allow for first complex chemistry, and then a life-friendly planet like Earth. So if you start thinking about all that, you take it a little less for granted.
That's so true. You know, when you speak like this, it brings tears to my eyes because when you study the science and you think about how marvelous it is, you look at this and you say, this is just amazing the way these pieces have come together. So for example, in a cell, all of these different interactions are going, and all of these different pieces. I want to do a thought experiment so maybe the audience can realize, you know, Steve and I sometimes we'll call each other for some short little thing, and we'll end up spending over an hour on the phone speaking together about whatever topic is latest to speak about in science. So Steve, think about this thought experiment. People always want to take the basic chemicals and make them. So you've got to have the nucleic acids, the amino acids, the lipids, and the saccharides. They always try to make these. They're abysmal at trying to make these under any prebiotic conditions. And generally, when they're made, they're racemic. They're not optically pure. And if there is some chirality, the optical purity is very low. But then stringing them together is another problem. But say you had all these pieces, and how do you assemble them into a cell? We have no idea how to assemble them into a cell. How to take this DNA and wrap it around a histone to just get the enzymes just going just right to do that. We're clueless on these sorts of things. But let's, in this thought experiment, say we already have a functioning working cell. So everything is in place, but now the cell just dies. Just died a nanosecond ago. It just died. What did we just lose? And what would we have to do to get it going again? Because everything is approximately in place. Have we any idea how to get this cell going again?
Well, it's the Humpty Dumpty problem, right? You've got all of these pieces, but all those pieces does not a living organism make. And there's a more technical name for this problem in Origin of Life studies, as you know, the Leventhal paradox. You know, you've got even if you start with all the proteins, it turns out, the number of different ways of arranging all those proteins that have nothing to do with life vastly outstrips. It's a huge exponential number. It's 10 to the 66 million or something. I have to look it up. I was just writing about it, but it's a huge exponential
10 to the 79, exactly. 10 to the 79 billion. 10 to the 79 billion in a single
billion.
Cell.
Yeah.
The 10 to the 66 million is the number of different models, inflationary cosmological models that do not result in a life-friendly universe. So that's another one of these, you know, fine-tuning parameters. I got the two huge exponential numbers mixed up. But yeah, that Leventhal thing. So you've got all these different pieces. You have all the right pieces. Original life scientists are straining to get amino acids under realistic prebiotic conditions. And as you've shown so beautifully, they can't do it without all kinds of investigator interference. They have to use very precise recipes and introduce the right reagents at the right time and remove the byproducts that they don't want so they don't get interfering crass reactions. And all they're getting in the end of the day is amino acids, which are just components of proteins that have to be arranged in very precise order. Well, the Leventhal paradox is, well, I'll give you all the proteins. And even with all the proteins, there's so many different possible ways of arranging them that don't result in an integrated living cell, that you're faced with these enormous search problems that are vastly beyond what we call the probabilistic resources of the universe. So the undirected chance plus necessity approach to the origin of life, I think, seems really hopeless. I think it's a non-starter. Intellectually, if you're really honest about what it takes to build a living organism, even the very simplest living organism.
Yes, I agree. Now, since you're a philosopher as well, so tell me, when we've just lost this functioning of the cell has just stopped working, so it's no longer alive. What is life? What is it we just lost? Tell it to me. What have we just lost?
What do they say in legal matters? That's a deep and imponderable question. I mean, I don't think people have tried in vain to define life, and we can define the necessary conditions of life, but we've all, I think, had the sense that there's something about life that's greater than the sum of its parts. And you don't have to be a cell biologist to know this. If you've ever lost a person that you love and you're with them at that moment of death, all the parts are still there, but the person is no longer there. What is that that's left? You know, in the biblical view, it's a spirit, a soul, a mind, and a spirit. It's something immaterial. And now, I don't know, when we're talking about a living cell as opposed to a human being, of the human being, I'm sure there's a spirit and a mind, you know, but there's something mysterious about life that we haven't really come to grips with. We know what's necessary from the standpoint of the physical substrates, what has to be in place to make life possible. But when life leaves, we don't exactly know what it is that's left, but we know something is left, and it's not just the physical.
Yeah, you know, if I could just try to reduce this to something utterly amazing that maybe our audience would want to think about. We are so clueless on this thing. If a cell just dies, it's hard for us to define what it is we just lost. Just try to describe what life was. What is it? Is it just this potential across a bilayer? No, it's many, many, many things together, and we're not sure even how to define that thing, let alone make it from the bottom up. We are utterly clueless. And people, what happens is people think that scientists have already figured this thing out. And so they just kind of accept it. Well, scientists know how to do that. They don't. They're clueless. Share something on this, Steve.
And even more so when it comes to the origin of life. It's hard enough to define what it is, but as you've shown, trying to explain how it got here from a prebiotic soup or whatever the theories. I mean, you and I both have a deep interest in this question. I did my PhD on it, and my first book, as you kindly shared with your audience, was about that. And you've been writing these fantastic articles for Inference and other places, holding these guys to account, because our students are told that we do have this all figured out. That chemistry in a warm little pond or in a prebiotic soup would have, with the right spark or lightning or something, would have reacted and naturally and gotten more and more and more complex. And we found that you actually, in the laboratory, you can't move life in a life, or you can't move the chemicals in a life-friendly direction without repeated interventions of intelligent investigators. And to my way of thinking, these simulation experiments in origin of life research or origin of life studies they have a particular logic about them. They're based on uniformitarian reasoning. The present is the key to the past. What we see happening in the laboratory is our guide to understanding what is plausible to think might have happened in the past. So when these investigators, time and time again, can't form even proteinaceous amino acids without, in a sense, cooking the book, setting up the experiment in just the right way, introducing just the right reagents in just at just the right time, removing the stuff so they don't get the interfering cross reactions, et cetera, et cetera. What are they actually simulating? It seems to me they're simulating the need for a mind to move the chemicals in a life-friendly direction. And at the same time, we still don't have a definition of what life is. We know it when we see it. We know when it's gone, but we know, and we know it's necessary. We know we need energy. We need to hold a complex system far from thermodynamic equilibrium. We need information. We need metabolic pathways. We need various things to make life. But those are necessary conditions that all have to be in a precise configuration with each other in order for there to be life as a whole. And yet we don't really have a complete definition, but the origin of life is utterly mystifying from a materialistic point of view, and every attempt to simulate it seems to suggest the need for a designing intelligence to superintend over the process.
That was the first part of three in a wide-ranging conversation between James M. Tour and Stephen C. Meyer. Be sure to come back for more as we continue this week. Or if you're checking back with us later on, you can find more of this conversation by looking up James M. Tour at idthefuture.com. And please remember, you can help get the word out on issues like these, such as Tour and Meyer have been discussing. Just go to your podcast app of choice and leave a favorable rating there and a good review for ID the Future. It helps a lot. Until next time for ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.